Hello, I'm Billy Shields. This is number 0230, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0230. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, legendary actress June Lockhart, one of TV's most beloved moms. She's still in touch with her TV kids.
John Provost, of course, in Lassie, a sweet little boy, and he's a dear guy. I see him now at our conventions. And then, of course, in Lost in Space, with Angela Cartwright and Billy Mumy and Marta Kristen, all of whom, we're all still in touch with each other by phone or sharing experiences or doing autograph conventions together.
Crime and investigative expert Suzanne McComas on the myths of TV crime shows. What are the biggest myths?
None of us look nearly that good. We don't look like Ken and Barbie. It's a big flaw. We don't have perfect hair and we work for a living. I think the second thing would be the speed that they do everything with. You know, they find the crime at 6 in the morning and they have it solved by noon. And it just doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. And this time, Book Banter says, here's Johnny with a new book on the life of Johnny Carson. So picture me swinging an imaginary golf club. As I say, I'll be right back on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0230 was Billy Shields, a reporter at Global News in Montreal, the other place that I work, which brings to the newscast the aura of the Billy Shields experience. Thank you very much, Billy, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, a hide-and-seek player found a hiding place so good she eventually concluded that she would never be found. So the unnamed girl, age 11, decided to climb out of the washing machine herself. But while she was curled up inside, her legs fell asleep, and she couldn't get herself out. Her mother and aunt tried to rescue her with butter, peanut butter, and ice, but they couldn't get her out either. The washer had a stackable dryer over it, so the door didn't open very far. Eventually, South Jordan, Utah firefighters removed the dryer, cut the washer to enlarge the opening, and got the girl out. "She won," said the girl's mother. "That's what I tell her. You're the best at hide-and-seek ever." Yeah, really? She's 11, and you're telling her she won? Yeah, so now you're going to just encourage she try even more stupid hiding stunts. This could become an even bigger problem as she gets older. You don't think so? Let me get to the next story, shall we? A naked Australian man who became stuck in a washing machine, yeah, you heard right, as part of an ill-planned practical joke, was freed from the appliance with the help of some olive oil. The 20-year-old man, identified only as Lawrence, said he was on his way to take a shower when he decided to climb into the top loader to have a bit of fun. What kind of fun? I'm not quite sure. But anyway, the fun quickly evaporated, however, when he realized he couldn't budge. He called out to his friend for help, who rang the police. They responded to the scene along with firefighters, paramedics, and a search and rescue squad. He was very well wedged in there, and we were concerned for his health and well-being, according to Police Sergeant Michelle D'Arago. It was just a game gone wrong. It would be fair to say the gentleman was very embarrassed. Rescuers tried in vain to pull Lawrence from the machine, but when it became clear he was seriously stuck, they grabbed a bottle of his favorite olive oil to help lubricate his escape. "I was quite disappointed that they used my good olive oil," Lawrence said. Yeah, would you have rather that they went out to the store and got a cheaper bottle of olive oil? Anyway, Lawrence went on to say, as soon as the washing machine was on its side, it was a bit like a birthing. I'm sorry. Did he just compare his mother's vagina to a washing machine? Well, that's an image Freud never had to deal with. Yeah. Meanwhile, an Oklahoma man is being held on suspicion of murdering his stepfather by giving him an atomic wedgie. Wow. So apparently the legend you heard in sixth grade are true. Anyway, police said Brad Lee Davis got into a drunken family fight with his stepfather, in which he grabbed the man's underwear, pulled it over his head, and suffocated him with the waistband. Police allege that the men got into a fight while drinking together when the victim made offensive remarks about his wife, who, of course, is Davis's mother. Okay, yeah, you have to admit, that's some strong quality underwear we're talking about here. I mean, I'm sure there would be a lot of brands that might have just ripped. Still, I don't think this would be a selling point for any underwear commercials. Just going on a limb to say that. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's another asinine zero-tolerance school policy. These things just drive me nuts. Anyway, two boys in Southeastern Middle School in Fawn Grove, Pennsylvania, had a several-second exchange, several seconds, that's all. One boy aimed his binder at the other and shot him with it, aimed a binder. All in pantomime, okay? In response, the other boy, 10-year-old Johnny Jones, held up his pencil as an arrow and drew it back in an imaginary bow. A girl saw the whole total silent exchange and reported it to a teacher who delivered a lecture about their disruption. Principal John Horton then suspended the boys, citing the school zero-tolerance weapons policy. Horton told Jones's mother that her son's threat was a serious offense. Yeah. The Jones family has engaged an attorney and is considering legal action. Only considering, really? Against the school if it doesn't now rescind the suspension. If it goes on his record as a weapons violation, it will follow him for the rest of his life, said John Whitehead, who has agreed to represent the boy. In some cases, I've seen the kids have trouble getting into college. Whitehead said the school's zero-tolerance policy deals with actual guns and replica weapons, but does not mention imaginary weapons. Well, unfortunately, while the district rules require teachers and principals to have credentials, they don't prohibit imaginary versions, I guess. That's just so asinine. You know, I sometimes want to give these clowns the idiots of the day, but oh, why waste the breath? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Actress June Lockhart is one of TV's most beloved moms. It's a role she's best known for in hit shows such as Lassie and Lost in Space. But June is much more than that. She is an actress whose career has spanned an amazing 8 decades, on screen and on stage. And her connection to space doesn't just end with a TV show. June Lockhart joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, June.
Hello, how are you, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, of course, I love all things Canadian. My father was born in London, Ontario, so I feel very close to Canadian people.
And your parents were in the business, and that's how you got into it so early, correct?
Well, yes. My first film that I did was Dickens' Christmas Carol for MGM, and they played Mr. and Mrs. Bob Cratchit, and I played Belinda. And we'd always performed a Christmas Carol for our Christmas dinner guests. So it was just a very natural thing, it seemed to me, to do it. The other roles that I had as a in my teens, I did just for the experience. And as my father said, if you these will be nice experiences for you, whether or not you ever want to be an actress when you grow up. So just delight in it for what it is for now. And, of course, I had to go to school on the set, and I kept up with my schoolwork at Westlake School for Girls, where I graduated. And so the important thing was getting an education, as far as he was concerned.
Now, speaking of one of those earlier roles, you were also in a film with Judy Garland, correct?
Yes, that was Meet Me in St. Louis. By that time, I had graduated and was under contract to MGM. And doing Meet Me in St. Louis was, of course, a joy. As a matter of fact, interesting thing about that part, it's very rare that in the fourth act of the show, a new character who is introduced, who comes in and solves everybody's problems and gets everybody organized and introduced as the person who solves the kids' problems. It was quite unusual.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you're also one of television's most beloved moms. You were both in Lassie and in Lost in Space.
And then, of course, I played the lady doctor in Petticoat Junction,
in
which
Petticoat
was a lovely part, and it was such fun to do comedy with those marvelously talented comedic actors.
Well, let's touch on Petticoat Junction for a moment, because that's a situation where you stepped into a role after the lead had, unfortunately, taken ill.
Yes.
Bea Benaderet.
I think by the time I started to work there, Bea Benaderet had already died.
Yeah.
That's my memory of it, at least. And I know that, I think it was, well, I don't know what it was that killed her. It was cancer of some sort, and the producer had been was a friend of mine whom I'd known socially for years, and so when he offered me the role, Lost in Space had just finished, but it was all CBS, all those shows that I did, so it was a lovely happenstance for me to be able to just go into the show, and it was a kind of a seamless change. I just stepped in, and there it was.
So it wasn't
in a completely new character.
I was about to say, it wasn't in any way, shape, or form a difficult situation, as opposed
no,
to other shows you did.
Because I walked on the set of my first day and called out, "Good morning, everybody!" And they knew we were all off and running, and everything was fine.
That's great.
Also, I had never known Bea Benaderet personally. There was no stuff on it in that way, you know.
Now, if I check trivia, is it true that you not only have a Tony, but you have the first Tony?
Yes, I have the first Tony for a debut performance, and that was for the 47-48 season of a play in which I made my debut, which was called For Love or Money, and I was 22 at the time.
What do you prefer? Do you prefer the big screen, small screen, or stage?
Well, I like it all. You know, it's all getting out there, learning the lines, rehearsing, and getting out there and doing it. It's really that simple. And I've always enjoyed television, and I was in on the very beginning, of course, of television. I did my first live TV, which was the Ford Theater in 1949. And it was Little Women and the Ford Fireside Theater. And so I may be one of the first actresses to ever participate in a live TV performance of a play like that, who is still living, I must say.
One of the things I mentioned in the introduction was the fact that you do have a connection with space beyond Lost in Space.
Oh, yes.
You have been around NASA quite a bit, have you not?
Well, it's really quite wonderful because in 1970, I was calling the Rose Parade, and I was able to interview Charles Conrad, Dick Gordon, and Alan Bean. They had just done the second landing on the moon, and they'd done two moonwalks, and as I say, the second lunar landing, and they were the duration of their whole flight had been 10 days, 4 hours, and 36 minutes, and I was able to interview them about their experience, and that pretty much started my connection with NASA, which has gone on now for all these years, and now NASA has used me as their spokeswoman. I've addressed their employees at Edwards Air Force Base. I've been to shuttle launches. I've been to Edwards Air Force Base for a NOAA launch of a satellite. I've been to their NASA headquarters, the John Glenn Center in Ohio. I've been, and of course, many trips to Houston for the Space Center there. And then when the Endeavour landed here in Los Angeles, I was there and at LAX, and then subsequently was able to address 15,000 people in at the Forum, and then was there when it was arrived down at the California Science Center. And Endeavour was one of the shuttle launches that I had been to years before. So and I'm in touch with them all the time, and it's extraordinary. I've also been to several and emceed concerts at the Kennedy Center to celebrate various NASA events. It's quite extraordinary. It's really a lovely experience.
As someone who has played a television mom and is quite known for that, what was it like for you as an actress working with the kids?
Oh, well, it's John Provost, of course, in Lassie. He was a sweet little boy, and he's a dear guy. I see him now at our conventions. And then, of course, in Lost in Space with Angela Cartwright and Billy Mumy and Marta Kristen, all of whom, we're all still in touch with each other because we, by phone or sharing experiences or doing autograph conventions together. Working with them when they're quite young is interesting because, of course, they have to get in their schoolwork done, as did I when I was their age. And although I don't know what their schooling was when they were away from the set. Mine, I know, was excellent because I went to Westlake School for Girls.
Was it easier for you to understand the life of a child actor because you yourself had been one?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Oh, certainly. And when they're working, like, for instance, Billy Mumy would be working, and he would, the welfare worker, as they're called, which is the teacher on the set, the students have to have 20 minutes of schooling, at least, in lumps, so that we'd be doing a scene, and the teacher would be there and would say, he's got to go back to school now. The day is running out, and he's got another 20 minutes he has to do. Or he would be in the middle of a test, and they'd come to his dressing room or to come to the schoolroom and say, "Okay, we need you now, Billy." And she'd stop the clock and send him off to do his scene. So it's very difficult, but you know, children are very flexible, right. And so it was just part of what he did and what I did.
Now, I understand that you've been selected as one of the 9 legendary ladies of stage and screen to have items from your career inducted into the Smithsonian Institute. That must be an amazing honor for you.
Well, that would be the Tony, my original Tony Award, which in those days when they gave it out was, I think, a wallet for the men, and for the ladies, it was a beautiful gold bracelet with a disc on it, which said what the award was. And so I gave my original one to the Smithsonian, but I had it copied exactly by a fine jeweler here in Santa Monica.
With all that you've done in a career, as I said earlier, that spans 8 decades, is there anything that you haven't had a chance to do that you've wanted to?
Well, I just take it as it comes, you know. It's really extraordinary, and it seems to be no end in sight. And with this wonderful award, that recognition that I've just received from NASA, which is the Exceptional Public Achievement Medal, it's quite beautiful, with the shuttle flying off into space, and it says NASA underneath it. And it was a total surprise to me when I got the card saying that I had been selected. I couldn't believe it. I took the card with me as I did my errands that day. I put it on the seat in the car beside me, and at every stop sign, I picked it up and read it again. I put it down and drove another five blocks and got a red light and read it again. I was in absolute awe of this wonderful, wonderful compliment and this generous thing that they have done for me.
Would you like to go into space?
No.
No?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Not at this point. I'd like to be there, but I don't want the trip up.
Gotcha. June, it's been an absolute delight to have a chance to talk with you, and I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad we talked.
Legendary actress June Lockhart, an absolute delight to talk to, best known for her roles as the moms in both Lassie and Lost in Space.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to a crime and investigative expert about the myths in TV crime shows. Plus, Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter. And of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. And lots more Stuff File news right here, right now on a program I also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, police in California say an alleged would-be bank robber fled empty-handed when a teller was unable to read the handwriting on his robbery note. Investigators say Jamal Garrett, age 29, handed a note demanding cash to a teller at the Wells Fargo Bank in Antioch around 9:45 a.m., but the teller had difficulty reading his handwriting. Police said the teller called a manager to help her discern the contents of the note, and the suspect left through the back door of the bank while the teller and manager were attempting to interpret his handwriting. The bank workers eventually determined the note was a robbery note and contacted police. Police said they later received a report of a suspicious man at Somersville Town Center, and officers determined the man matched the description of the suspect from the bank. Witnesses identified him as the same man from the Wells Fargo incident. Garrett was arrested on a charge of attempted bank robbery and an outstanding warrant for parole violations. You see, Mom was always right. Decent penmanship is one of the keys to success. Live and learn, Jamal. Live and learn. When police in Daytona Beach Shores, Florida, pulled over a stolen car at 3:30 a.m. with three occupants, the three occupants were not very cooperative with the officers, but it was an odd mix. A young couple accompanied by a 72-year-old man. It took a while to sort it all out, but the woman, Angel Miller, age 33, was a stripper at the Shark Lounge. The driver, Shalimar Lawrence, 33, is her boyfriend. And their passenger, Robert Cook, couldn't say who the couple were, just that the black guy was driving me home. Lawrence said he and his girlfriend were giving Cook a ride because he had provided Miller with half of the money that she had earned from dancing that evening, according to the officer's report. Miller said she didn't know Cook, but he had spent $8 on her while she danced. Miller and Lawrence were arrested and charged with car theft. Cook was arrested and charged with possession of methamphetamine. Okay, let's do the math here. If Cook was half of her take stripping that night, that means Miller only made $16. I don't have a picture of her, so I don't know if that amount says more about her or the club she works in. I just hope it wasn't $8 all in dimes. Anyway, the Metropolitan Atlanta Mass Transit Authority has had an ongoing problem with the elevators taking passengers down to the subways. If you've ever been in a porta potty, that's what it smelled like before, according to MARTA Director of Elevators and Escalators, that's Tom Beeb. Passengers had to suffer through the strong smell since people had been using elevators as urinals. But they have developed a solution, urine detectors. The city installed a test system in one elevator, which includes better lighting, a camera, and a detector, which sounds an alarm when someone relieves themselves inside, allowing police to respond quickly and catch the offender. In a month-long test, there was only a single incident, which resulted in an arrest. The city is now seeking to install the system in all 111 elevators in the MARTA system at an estimated cost of $10,000. Each. Oh, and they're also reopening the restrooms in 4 stations, which they hope will help with the problems. Okay, seriously? You're planning to spend $10,000 per elevator to stop people from peeing in them when all this time you have had closed restrooms? I mean, did you ever think to perhaps open the restrooms first and see if the problem went away that way? I mean, if you're going to go with expensive, far-fetched solutions, perhaps you should just simply electrify the floors and the corners. I'm sure peeing in them would then be something somebody does just once. Just once. Anyway, government in action. Moving right along, employees at a Canton, Ohio GameStop store were suspicious after a man traded in several games and gaming systems. They called a local Kmart about the items, and that triggered a 3-month investigation that resulted in the arrest of a Kmart employee who was allegedly stealing the items from Kmart and taking them to GameStop to sell. He was arrested at the Kmart where he was employed as, wait for it, the store's loss prevention manager. Yeah, well, he definitely got the loss part down. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in November, Dave Wilson, a white conservative candidate for the board of the Houston Community College System, pulled off an astonishing victory over the African-American incumbent by distributing campaign material that made him, Wilson, appear to be black, and thus the favorite of African Americans. Wilson's brochures depicting black supporters were all, he said later, copied from the internet. Yeah. Ain't democracy grand? That's all I'm going to say to that one. Let's just get to our next guest, shall we? Just how real is the world of criminal investigation as depicted on television? Well, to delve into the answer to that question, we're joined by Susan McComas, who is a nationally known crime and investigative expert and the founder of ZZ Agency and the author of several books. Hi, Suzanne. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Thanks for being on the program with us. We often see television shows and we see crime scenes being depicted and investigations taking place. When you watch it with the knowledge that you have, what is the biggest misrepresentation you see in television?
That none of us look nearly that good. We don't look like Ken and Barbie.
Okay, that aside, what else?
Sorry, it's a big flaw. We don't have perfect hair and we work for a living. I think the second thing would be the speed that they do everything with. You know, they find the crime at 6 in the morning and they have it solved by noon. And it just doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
One of the things I've always questioned watching these shows, and I'm wondering if it also makes it difficult to find actual juries in real life, because so many people watch television shows, is with the speed and accuracy that television shows depict the use of DNA.
Well, I think it certainly raised the level of expectation in the jury pool. They will not just take your word for it anymore. They want to see what you've got. And as they've become educated on the technology for evidence collection and what's available out there, I have had them say to me when I've done my jury polls after the case that they didn't see enough to cause a conviction, or they knew how that was supposed to work, so they knew it was done wrong. And that's not something you heard 10 years ago from juries. So they've become much more educated on what the process is. Technologically, the crime shows do show it correctly. It's the timing. You know, they send out a DNA sample for processing and they get the results back after lunch. If a police department sends out a DNA sample to the state crime lab, they're lucky if they get it back in 2 months.
Yes.
So it's a big difference, and that's a big disconnect for people when they're involved in a crime. They don't understand why you don't have that back by Thursday. You know, and you have to explain to them that's not how it works.
Yeah, it's not exactly Martinizing, is it? No, not like you're dry cleaning, not back in an hour.
No. And the only exception to that is if you've seen one of these horrific crimes where the parent was killed and the child is missing, then they will take that one right to the front of the line and run it so that they can get a resolution on a kidnapping. So anything that's a kidnapping, that's an active crime like that, they will jump that right to the head of the line and take care of it right away.
Okay. Now, on the other side of the coin, what are some of the things you see television getting right?
Well, in the fictional shows, they do tend to show the criminal process correctly. It's the timing that's bad. Law and Order, as far as the sequencing in court and everything, is very accurate. You know, you go in for your initial plea, and then you have all the pushing and shoving by the attorneys before you go to trial. The biggest problem is that everybody goes to trial on that. In the United States, 96% of criminal cases are plea deals. They do not go to trial. It's very rare someone goes to a full-blown jury trial. Very rare. So that's a misconception.
96%? That seems to be awfully high.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, but that's the way it is last year. That's where it was at. And now we're throwing all the cases in there from misdemeanor up to major felonies. But, you know, that is a true statistic. It's 96% of their plea deal the result. That's it. It never goes to trial.
The only thing I'm concerned about in that high number is I would be concerned about a defense lawyer coercing or pushing a person into a plea deal because they're convinced that they cannot be exonerated from a crime that they did not commit.
Well, when someone's truly innocent, they will occasionally look at that and say, look, you're going to lose anyway, so you might as well take the plea deal. It's a lesser charge. And I've had a lot of clients say, but I didn't do it. And they said, well, you're going to lose anyhow. And they do push them to take the plea deal, whether or not they believe in their innocence or not. Now, I take sentencing advocacy cases every year pro bono, and I have one that I just started. If you go to my website, there's a page there that says Justice for Brian, and he's one of those rare inmates who truly is innocent of the crime he was convicted of. He's done 14 years on a 45-year sentence, and we're going to put in a motion for a new trial for his sentence to be vacated sometime this spring. It's really, you don't run into those a lot, but I think you hear about them in the news more and more as some of these guys are getting exonerated from DNA evidence or the false confessions. The Innocence Project's gotten more and more successful as it's gone on. And I've taken ones that I knew I could win, and I don't mean that in an arrogant sense. It's just I like to spend my time where it's going to be effective. And I've gotten back over 200 years of time for my clients and got them out that much earlier. So it is a flawed system in that respect every once in a while. But it will self-adjust if you bring it the information it needs. It'll self-adjust and make it right.
Well, you just mentioned the case. You mentioned Justice for Brian. Tell us a little about that and how you got involved.
Well, I take one case a year because it does take a lot of time and energy. And when I say pro bono, that means I don't get paid anything to do these. And his case came on my radar from one of his family members. They did an online search and found me and said, please take a look at this and help him. And when I went back and reviewed his case, I actually was shocked that it even went to trial against him. They had nothing on him as far as evidence except four people saying that he told them he did it. And he was on drugs at the time, and they were all drug addicts, and they were all looking at charges. They all got plea deals to testify against him. He had an alibi. He was with someone at the time the homicide occurred, and his alibi witness got told by his attorney to plead the fifth or he would get jammed up on it too, so the guy would not testify on his behalf, and that was it. It was over. He got convicted. And he's maintained his innocence ever since. He's willing to take a polygraph, whatever it takes, and he really is one of those guys that should never have gone to jail.
He wasn't
a choir boy, don't get me wrong. Yeah. I mean, he was running in the drug scene, and I think that's what people expect people like me to say. You know, butter wouldn't melt in their mouth, but that's not true. You know, these guys are in this situation for a reason, but that doesn't make them a killer. And he's in that category.
Well, that was the question I was just about to ask. Is part of the problem that the justice system and by extension the juries, they figure, well, as you say, this person is not a choir boy. He may not be guilty of this, but he's guilty of something.
I've had jurors say that to me. Yeah. I literally have heard them say that. You know, I've had one juror look at me and he goes, well, look, you can look at the guy and tell he's a scumbag. So if he didn't do this, he did something. And when you dehumanize somebody like that, it makes it easy not to see their side of the grid. You've got a defense client sitting there at the table that is a drug addict who, you know, has issues. And your witnesses are all coming in orange jumpsuits and belly chains to testify against him. And here you have 12 people in the jury box who are good people, respectable people, and all they want to do is get away from this whole nasty mess. It just repulses them. The witnesses are offensive. The defendant's offensive. And they just want to go home and take a shower. They don't want any of these people in their neighborhood. And who can blame them? You know, who can blame them? So they just basically say, all right, you know what? We don't like him. We're going to convict on emotion. We don't really want it. They said he said he did it, so whatever. He says he did, and we don't believe him. We're done. We're out of here. And that happens a lot. That happens a lot. It's very hard to, I don't care what anybody says, you know, even in a job interview, the first 20 seconds, supposedly, you either have the job or you don't. It's all about first impressions. So when your defendant makes a bad first impression and the crowd he's been running with makes a horrible impression, you know, people are people and they convict on emotion. And that happens more than we like to admit.
Or the lawyer makes a bad impression. That could hurt too, could it not?
Oh, yeah, and a lot of them do. A lot of them do, especially when they get a little jaded. You know, that the courtroom attorneys need to come in with confidence and with a little bit of a style.
Right.
And they have to be compelling. You know, there's public speaking engagement, basically. So you can think of any Chamber of Commerce speaking engagement you went to when somebody got up there and just basically read from a notebook. You know, I mean, you practically fall asleep halfway through and you can't remember half the stuff he said. But when you get a public speaker up there who's engaging and personable and looks you in the eye, it makes all the difference. And you want to like him and you want to like his side of the story. So it does come down to personalities and speaking ability on the two attorneys, too. And I've seen a lot of defense attorneys who failed miserably in that category. They got up there and they mumbled. They had their hands in their pockets. They didn't make eye contact. And the jury was just looking at him like, I got nothing. You know, and it's over before it begins.
I want to get that website in. It's important because you were working on this case, Justice for Brian. Where can people find information about this?
My website is ZZ, like zebra, zebra, ZZAgency.com. And they can see my books there. I have all my books on one page. I have Justice for Brian there. If you don't mind, I'd like to just ask if anybody's willing to make a donation towards his legal expense, we'd appreciate it. We've got a little spot there. You can make a donation, whatever you feel comfortable with. We're asking for $31 from everybody, which is $1 for each year we're trying to get back for him. And they can read about my private investigation work, which I'd love to do. That's my bread and butter. That's how I pay the bills.
Okay.
So, you know, they've got lots of good stuff there they can go see. And if they have anything they want to write me about privately, a case they want to write me about, they can get a hold of me through there.
And we have less than a minute, so I just asked this one question to go back to our original topic, and that is basically, if you had the opportunity to change one thing on a television show, what would it be?
One thing to change. Gosh, you know, I think I would change the whole demeanor of everyone on CSI so that they were more gritty. I always loved Homicide: Life on the Streets. I felt like that was so realistic, the way they portrayed the detectives. They weren't pretty. They weren't good-looking. They were hardworking. They were real. They had emotions, and they struggled with their work because it's a very hard job to do. And I always thought that that was the most realistic depiction of police work I'd ever seen on television, and I still think that.
Suzanne, thank you very much for being on the program with us. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
You too. Thank you.
Crime and investigative expert Suzanne McComas. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0230, and you'll find links to Suzanne's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you ever received a letter telling you that you were part of a class action lawsuit? Class actions have become a big business. Many plaintiff lawyers claim that these lawsuits are the best way to help the so-called little guy get justice when corporate America does something wrong. However, an in-depth study of all the class actions filed in America in one recent year reveals that in the vast majority of cases, the class members that the lawyers claimed to be fighting for ended up empty-handed. In fact, in 2/3 of the class actions in the study that were settled, the lawyers failed to get even one penny for any of the class members. Let's be fair, some of the class actions did achieve good results, but virtually none of those were the consumer class actions that so often make the news. The bottom line is that consumers need other options for resolving disputes because class actions so often fail. One option is arbitration, and there are others. To find out more, visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And we have, once again, torn Stuart Nauman away from late-night television so that he can be on the program to talk with us. He's usually blurry-eyed from watching everything that's on at night, but he's here now with us. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Peter, and I'll say, here's Jimmy.
Here's Jimmy?
Yeah. Well, this year is going to be a big year in late-night TV, because, and Tonight Show in particular, because one host is going, the other one's going to be coming in, actually. Well, Jay Leno's going to leave the chair.
Oh, well, let's be clear. Jay Leno's being catapulted from the chair.
Oh, okay, but you have to agree with this. Jimmy Fallon is going to be filling that chair.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, that's right. So,
actually, he's going to be moving that chair and then filling that chair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true. Back to where The Tonight Show started, in New York.
Yes.
Wow. Now, we're going to talk about, not The Tonight Show, but a former host of The Tonight Show, Johnny Carson. And, you know, Johnny Carson was a TV pioneer who helped to revolutionize the late-night talk show when he hosted Tonight Show for 30 years. He was a generous, charitable, talented man. But on the other hand, he was a cruel, distant, insecure, and reclusive individual. Now, Henry Bushkin, who served as Carson's lawyer from 1970 to 1988, worked closely with him and personally experienced the two faces of the TV legend.
I believe the correct name is Bombastic Bushkin.
Yes, that's right. And Carson gave him that name, actually. So Bombastic Bushkin explores Carson in fascinating detail in this biography entitled, plainly enough, Johnny Carson. Now, this is not a typical biography that chronicles the 80 years of Carson's life and career. Instead, we get an intense portrait of Johnny Carson as seen through the eyes of one of his closest friends and confidants during an 18-year period when Johnny Carson became the most recognized and richest personality on television. This was a period when he became the king of late night. Now, Bombastic Bushkin was there to witness all of this, In fact, he had a hand in engineering the elevation of Carson to such heights in the entertainment industry. When he was hired to become his attorney back in 1970, Bushkin realized that Carson was well paid by NBC to host The Tonight Show, but somehow saved very little of his salary. Unfortunately, Carson's entourage was virtually bleeding him dry, and the profits from lucrative endorsements, such as Carson's popular line of menswear during the early and mid-70s, were going into the pockets of the men who were supposed to look after his affairs. So Bushkin remedied this situation by convincing Carson to purge these people. He then had Carson invest his money wisely in order to hold on to the rights of the tapes of his past Tonight Show broadcasts and generate revenues from them as a producer of other TV shows. Bushkin helped to create Carson Productions. And then it was also Bushkin who engineered the negotiation with the network that resulted in Carson's astronomical salary of $25 million a year, including 15 weeks of vacation annually. And back in 1980, that was a lot of change, I'll tell you that.
You'd think that with the success that Johnny Carson had, especially early in his career and especially early in The Tonight Show, and being at NBC, that he would have learned a thing or two about saving his money from people like, oh, let's say, Bob Hope.
Yeah. And it's ironic, in an episode of The Simpsons, the one that Krusty gets canceled, it's Carson who tells him, Krusty, save your money. Very ironic.
Very ironic, because I believe by the time Bob Hope died, he had more money than God.
Yes, and you know, still, you know, even though he's been dead for over 10 years, still don't know how to spend all that money that Hope made.
Yeah.
Still a lot of money. But however, with the fame and extraordinary wealth that made up the balance of Carson's career on television came the moments where Bushkin saw Carson's dark side many times over. There was a raid that Carson conducted in 1970 on the New York love nest of his second wife, Joanne, where he discovered that she was having an affair with Frank Gifford. His mercurial temper that when things didn't go his way. These are some of the examples.
I've heard the Frank Gifford story. I've heard the raid story.
Yeah.
Can we say it's true, though? I'm not doubting its validity. I'm just questioning its validity.
But Bushkin was there. He said he witnessed it. Nelson Carson was concealing a gun. Actually, I don't know what it was in Carson's mind, but Carson was, how can I say, at that time of the raid, was not in a good frame of mind, actually.
Well, to be honest, there were a lot of times when Johnny Carson was not in the right frame of mind.
Oh, yes. And you know what? Here's one thing in this respect, is that Carson's tendency to be a cold, distant, unhappy, and loveless person, which he attributed to his mother, Ruth, who never showed any pride in her son's accomplishments or appreciated anything he ever did for her as he reached the heights of fame as host of The Tonight Show. So, there's some reasons why Johnny Carson was like that. But this book offers plenty of terrific details and stories of the two sides of Johnny Carson. And the overall conclusion that you get once you finish reading this is that Carson worked hard to become king of late night, and that wouldn't have been possible without the tireless efforts of his consigliere, Henry Bombastic Bushkin. However, because of his endless insecurities, boredom, and inability to accept and enjoy his hard-earned wealth and fame, he spent the rest of his life ruling over an empty kingdom all by himself. So Johnny Carson, the book, is an intimate, eye-opening book of one of the most revered and most complex figures in the history of television by a person who not only worked very closely with Johnny Carson, but also had the difficult task of trying to understand what made him tick.
Does the book touch on his difficult relationship with his sons and the death of one of his sons?
Yes, it touches everything that dealt with Carson personally and professionally during that 18-year period, and also includes, you know, his tenuous relationship with his sons, and also the death of Rick as well. So yes, it's there.
I'm curious to know what the real relationship between him and Angie Dickinson. That's what I want to know.
According to Bombastic Bushkin, they were just friends. They just dated for a while. That's basically what it was.
Yeah. All righty then. The book is called
Johnny Carson by Henry Bushkin. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and it's $36.
And if you enjoy reading this, what else would you like in this similar vein?
Well, three books very quickly. One, the first biography of Carson to reveal the many sides of him. It was called King of Late Night by Lawrence Leamer. And then you got to get the two volume 1-2 punch by Bill Carter called The Late Shift, and also The War for Late Night, which it covers the battle to succeed Johnny Carson, and then afterwards the battle to keep the Tonight Show chair between Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien. Terrific two volumes about what goes on behind the scenes in the late night talk show wars.
Excellent. And how can people find you, Mr. Nolman, sir?
Well, you can find me, Peter, sir, at the Montreal Times, published every Saturday in print. But if you can't see me in print, you can read me online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome, Ed. I mean, Peter, sorry.
Stuart Nellman with another edition of Book Banter, who obviously wants to be Arthur Treacher, here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do, of course, have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments. But first, a few more Stuff File news stories before we get there. In November, the senior class president of Northwestern Christian University in Eugene, Oregon, came out as an atheist. Eric Fromm, who is 21, is apparently popular on campus, and an ABC News report revealed that he was under no pressure to resign or drop out, said the director of university relations. All of our students are on a journey. We, as an institution, meet students where they are at. Fromm said he was impressed with the school right from his initial visit. No one was speaking in tongues or handling snakes, so I decided to stay. Yes, the Lord does indeed work in mysterious ways, doesn't he? Or she, depending how you feel about that. A condominium association in Niles, Illinois, is debating whether to pursue Norman Kazmierski since he has now moved. As a resident, he was accused of keying cars, egging hallways, disabling emergency sprinkler systems, and leaving several pounds of excrement in the buildings in protest of alleged mistreatment. I wonder if that excrement was his or not. Anyway, the association said it all started when one resident asked Norman to please park his car between the lines so that parking spaces could be used more efficiently. Oh, you get the feeling his kindergarten report card must have said had difficulty playing with others. Yeah, I don't think we have to go too far out on a limb to see that light. Moving right along, 46-year-old Suzette Hall and her partner opened Rebel Beauty, a beauty parlor in Johnstown, Colorado. But her partner later told an investigator that the relationship went south when Hall decided to offer haircuts while topless and then allegedly started offering house calls for more than just haircuts. Hall then moved to nearby Loveland. Yes, ironic, isn't it? And, according to witnesses, is charging $45 for topless haircuts and is advertising on Craigslist. Police arrested Hall, who has 9 previous felony convictions, the charge this time practicing cosmetology without a license. Yes, because selling your body is fine, but how dare you give a haircut without a license? Good call. Yeah. And a fire late New Year's Eve destroyed about 350 porta-potty toilets at a rental business in East Bexar County, Texas. The fire began at around 10:30 p.m. Officials said they believe the stray fireworks started a grass fire that spread to the business. United's website said the business is the largest provider of portable toilets and restroom trailers in the country. Well, that's a crappy situation, huh? Yeah. Anyway, let's, folks, because it's that time of the program, let's now get to the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
A British woman tried to sue her former lawyers because they failed to tell her the divorce settlement she wanted would cause the end of her marriage. Huh? Jane Mulcahy attempted to take action against 2 law firms that she had used, saying they did not make it clear what the outcomes of her divorce proceedings would be. It is believed Mulcahy is Catholic and that her lawyers had not taken her faith into account. She claims that judicial separation, which is less severe than divorce, should have been recommended instead. The details of the attempted legal action were revealed at an appeal court hearing after Mulcahy objected to the outcome of her original case. Lord Justice Briggs, who presided over the appeal proceedings, said that Mulcahy's claim was a striking one, and her case was rejected by the court. Now, why would someone think that divorce wouldn't end their marriage? And why were the courts so quick to reject her claim? Well, one reason, and one reason only, is because they realized she's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0230. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0230. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.